Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2002, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a psychologist. On her own admission, she spent the first 40 years of her life being unhappy, an experience she's put to good use in highly successful books about depression and how to deal with it. Born in Australia, she came to this country more than 30 years ago, where, at the University of Sheffield, she began to gain a reputation for studying psychology from the point of view of people's individual experiences rather than general theory. This is what's been the foundation of her success and the subject matter of her influential books. She admits to being a maverick along the way, but one whose controversial ideas have gradually received wide acceptance. The cure for depression, she says, is not pills, but wisdom. She is Dorothy Rowe. And does that wisdom, Dorothy, come from within or without? Do you need a therapist to show you where it is or to tell you what it is, or can you do it yourself?
Most people, as they get older, acquire wisdom from their experience. We all learn from our experience, and we can learn from what other people tell us. We learn a lot from the conversations we have.
But if you get into that black hole of depression, can you get yourself out of it?
I've seen hundreds of people do that.
What, by themselves?
By themselves, and by talking to people and trying to understand how they see themselves, and then realizing that the way we see ourselves in our world is a set of ideas. They're ideas that we've created, and we're free to change those ideas.
So the thesis is that you've put yourself in that black hole by perceiving yourself in the way that you do, and therefore you can get yourself out of it.
It sounds cruel to say you put yourself in that hole, but it arises out of the way you see yourself in your world. And you've had very good reason for seeing yourself like that, because you've had those kind of experiences from which you've drawn these ideas.
But that's been what's been controversial, as I understand it, about what you've said over the years. You have said depression is not genetic. It's not something you inherit. It's not a disease that you catch. It's not a chemical imbalance in the brain. It's you perceiving the world in a certain way and shooting yourself down, as we say, into that hole.
Yes, and this applies to everything that we do.
But why have professional psychologists over the years found that so difficult to accept? It sounds very obvious, you know, that it's a state brought about by the manner in which you view the world and your place in it.
When I started work on this whole question of why we behave as we do, the thinking among psychiatrists was that all behaviour could be explained in terms of bodily processes. And psychologists weren't interested in depression or any of the major psychiatric disorders. But I came to England at a time when a particular way of working in psychology called personal construct psychology had been brought to England, and I found in that body of work a way of presenting my ideas. Now, this way of working has become ordinary now. And the basis of it is that what determines our behaviour isn't what happens to us, but how we interpret what happens to us.
I want to pursue that with you, but let's pause. Tell me about your first record.
Whenever I hear Ella Fitzgerald sing Every Time We Say Goodbye, I remember those glorious times when I was in love and when the world looks so different, when your beloved is in front of you, everything shines, and when he goes away, everything turns grey.
There's no love song finer, but how strange the change from major to minor. Every time we say goodbye.
Ella Fitzgerald and Every Time We Say Goodbye. Having said, though, that each case is unique, which is what we were saying that is your thesis, you are prepared to make some generalisations, aren't you? Because you say there's a pattern, and that pattern, that recipe, if you like, for depression, begins in childhood.
Yes. It begins in childhood when the toddler ceases to think of himself as being quite acceptable. You know, by the time we're toddlers, we've learnt that you have to work hard to be good. And once you've learnt that and become an expert in being good, you've laid the cornerstone for the prison of depression.
So in later life, when something awful happens to you, if your spouse leaves you or you get the sack or whatever it is, you immediately think, it's because I'm bad.
That's right, because good people always blame themselves. So when a disaster happens to a good person doesn't say, oh, well, it just happened by chance, or it was somebody else's fault. A good person says, it was my fault.
And if you believe that strongly enough, you tumble into the hell of depression, yes?
The way to turn sadness into depression is to blame yourself for the disaster that's befallen you.
Having said all of that, when people get depressed, you know, if they can then go to the doctor and get themselves labelled, you know, clinically depressed, it's almost as if that's a safe haven, isn't it? That actually you are on firm ground. It's called rock bottom, but, you know, you're on firm ground rather than flapping about in the wind, not knowing quite why you feel so miserable.
Nowadays, diagnosis of depression is very popular. So a lot of people are getting it when actually they're deeply sad, or they're extremely anxious.
Because there's a big difference between unhappiness and depression.
It's a huge difference. When we're unhappy, other people can actually comfort us. We can feel the warmth of their comfort. But when we're depressed, we've turned against ourselves and we hate ourselves. And when other people try to comfort us, nothing gets through to us. Mm. The experience of depression is being in a prison. Intellectually, you know you're still in the same sort of world that you've always been in. But in terms of what you're experiencing, there's a barrier between you and everything else, everybody else. And when you're in the prison of depression, it's horrible because you're totally on your own, but you are excluding. On the other side of that wall is all the chaos that's threatening to overwhelm you.
Tell me about your second record.
Well, my second record is the first record I ever listened to on my grandmother's wind-up gramophone called The Runaway Train. And I'd look at the picture above her mantelpiece, and it was of a coach and horses, and at the front, sitting beside the coachman, was a young boy. And I'd make up lots of stories about him, and they were all about escaping. And, of course, my life has been very much about escaping.
'Twas in the year of 89, on that old Chicago line, when the winter wind was blowing shrill. The rails were froze, the wheels were cold, and then the air brakes wouldn't hold, and number 9 came roaring down the hill. Oh, the runaway train came down the track and she blew. The runaway train came down the track and she blew. The runaway train come down the track, the whistle wide and the throttle back, and she blew.
Vernon Dalhart singing The Runaway Train, which equals escape, which is what you, Dorothy Rowe, aged 5, living in the seaside town of Newcastle in southeast Australia, wanted to do. What did you want to escape from?
My mother. My mother was a very difficult woman. Years later, when I was working as a psychologist and talking to lots of depressed women, I kept meeting her. And I came to realise that that was Ella's problem. The family never said she was depressed, but the whole family, not just my father and my sister and myself, but all her sisters and her mother, everybody, we all lived on the principle, don't upset Ella.
And how did it affect you as a child?
Because I was the youngest and I was there with her. And to other people, she was really lovely, very beautiful and very sweet and charming. But she took her rages out on me.
How?
Oh, beating me. And when she'd get tremendously upset, she would say she was going to kill me and then kill herself.
And did she ever show you any love?
It's a funny thing. I've thought about this a lot, and I'm still not sure. When she was quite old, and I'd ceased to be frightened of her, we had the only intimate conversation we ever had, and it was very brief. And she just said, well, we Sneddons, that was her maiden name, we Sneddons never show our feelings. And I said, Mum, you showed your anger. And she just smiled at that, and that was it.
So, what about your father? What role did he play in all of this? Because he was a salesman. He was obviously quite a sociable chap.
Oh, yes, he was just wonderful. But he told me when I was in my early 20s how disappointed he was that I was a girl and how he had to make an effort to love me when I was a baby. But I didn't feel that was bad because my father tried to love everybody.
It sounds completely miserable and awful. Obviously, as you say, you've thought about it a lot. I wonder, I mean, can I just ask you this? It's kind of role reversal here. I seem to be the therapist. I don't mean to be. But I wonder, would a fly on the wall at the time back up everything, the sort of picture you've just painted? Or would they say, well, hang on, this is just your perception of it. In fact, they were just, your mother was just a not very demonstrative woman, couldn't show her love, but it was there, really.
They might well say that. But what they'd hear was a kind of a constant criticism. My sister has talked to me about how she, growing up, was terribly nervous because of the way my mother would always comment on the state of her hair or whether her breath smelt, things like that. And it really wasn't until I was working as a educational psychologist with disturbed children and working in child guidance clinics that it dawned on me that had child guidance clinics been around when I was a child, somebody would have sent my mother and me there.
Or you'd have put up your hand and said, please, can I come?
Please.
Yeah, absolutely. Record number three.
Well, not everything in my school days was bad. And one of the things at Newcastle Girls High School was that I learnt to dance. And I just love dancing. So on this island, I'm going to have Fred Astaire and the Continental, and I shall dance.
Beautiful music, dangerous rhythm. It's something daring, the Continental. A way of dancing that's really ultra new. It's very subtle, the Continental. Because it does what you want it to do. It has a passion, the Continental. An invitation to moonlight and romance. It's quite the fashion, the Continental.
Fred Astaire and the Continental sweeping you across the beach there. Wonderful. When did psychology enter your life then, Dorothy? When did you actually think, that's the word, that's the subject, that's what I want to pursue?
I sort of fell into it. I went to university expecting to major in English and history. When I got there, I found it terribly boring. And psychology was one of the subjects I had to do as, and it was marginally less boring. So that I ended up majoring in that.
But you see, the seeds of the maverick were in you, obviously, because you were openly critical then, I think, of the kind of education you were receiving. I mean, you weren't flattened by this childhood of yours, were you? You sound as if you were quite punchy.
As anyone who grew up in a difficult childhood knows, you either go under or you fight back. And I always think it's better to fight back.
But you've made this statement that you were more or less unhappy for 40 years. There were obviously bursts of happiness.
Yes.
I mean, presumably when you first got married, when you had your son, Edward. But it was really when you went back to work after that that you found your métier because you started to work with emotionally disturbed children. What was revolutionary about what you brought to that work with those kids?
I was very fortunate. I was liaison psychologist to a children's unit at North Ryde Psychiatric Hospital, and that unit was run by a wonderful woman, Dr. Sarah Williams. She saw every child as an individual. She didn't see them as cases of mental illness. And when I came to England, I expected psychiatry to be the same, and it was not. The case conferences were all about diagnosis and treatment with drugs and ECT.
And not visiting these patients, the clients, which are whatever you call them, in their own homes, which is what you did, isn't it?
Yes, when I was working in Sydney, I didn't have an office, so I would see the children and the parents in their own home. And one boy I've never forgotten was this lad who was supposed to be school phobic, and all the emphasis was on why he was frightened of school. But I discovered that there was Granny at home, and the boy eventually told me that Granny would say to him in the morning, "If you go to school today, I'll die." Now, I wouldn't have I didn't even know Granny's existence until I went there.
Record number four.
It's Ella Fitzgerald singing Just One of Those Things. Now, this was really growing up when I realised that if you fall in love, well, love comes to an end, and it is just one of those things.
That our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, and amen. Here's hoping we meet now and then. It was great.
Ella Fitzgerald and Just One of Those Things. Is that how you felt, Dorothy, when you turned your back on Australia and your marriage and everything and came to this country? You sort of put it behind. It was just one of those things. I'm moving on.
It was the best thing to do. It was quite traumatic and very scary because I didn't have a job, and the only money I had I'd spent on our boat fare coming over. So that was quite scary.
And you brought your small son, who would have been, what, about 9 or 10 at the time?
He was 9 at the time. Mm. Yes.
But one of the reasons you were attracted to coming was that you knew that your type of psychology was beginning to catch on here.
No, not really. It was, there was a change in the kind of research that psychologists were doing. And I'd been corresponding with Monty Shapiro at the Institute of Psychiatry, a great psychologist. And he said in a letter one day, "Why don't you come over here? There are lots of jobs."
Now, you would have been 38 when you did that. You say that you were unhappy for 40 years. Was there a moment then, after you'd arrived, when you realised, "I am no longer unhappy"?
It crept up on me slowly. But I remember one day when I was running the Department of Clinical Psychology in Lincolnshire, I walked out the door of the department and I saw the daisies floating on the grass like I've never seen them before. And I was aware that I felt different and the world was different. I guess that was happiness.
Mm. And was part of the reason for that happiness was, yes, you'd established a new life, but also, as we say, you were beginning to have your kind of theory of individual psychology being acceptable. And you had discovered this personal construct psychology.
Well, I was doing things which I knew were real. And I knew that people were getting something from it.
But this personal construct psychology doesn't have a leader. There is no Jung. There is no Freud. Why don't you have a leader? I mean, do you just sort of make secret signs to each other across
there's
the
There's a whole theater. Collection of us, and we're lovely people, and we have lots of conferences. But it's the ultimate democracy that each of us sees the world in our own individual way.
But you do put labels on groups of people, don't you? You know, conventional psychology, I think, accepts that there are extroverts and introverts. You just give them different labels. You call them people persons and what have I achieved today persons.
Yes, and I use the words extrovert and introvert. I didn't discover anything brand new. All the great theories about why people behave as they do, you know, Freud, Jung, Eysenck, all of those people came to the conclusion that the human race divides into two groups. There are people persons, extroverts, people for whom their relationships with others are the most important part of their life. And the rest of us are introverts, and I'm one. Our top priority is having a sense of some kind of achievement and order.
And you agree with that?
That's what I found. I didn't expect to find that. I expected to find this complete individuality all over. And I got a great shock.
So doesn't it contradict your thesis then? Isn't it proof that there is a neurological or genetic basis for the way we are?
We are all individuals, but we're all bodies. We're born with potential. But what happens to that potential depends on how we interpret that potential. For instance, I've got a lung disease, bronchiectasis, probably genetic, but I'm as well as I am, first of all, because I think I'm valuable and I'm going to live as long as I can. And secondly, I'm highly organised and somewhat obsessional. I carry out all the health routines.
And you do that because you're an introvert, because you look after yourself, and that's how you were born.
I was born as an introvert, but as an introvert, I still had to learn how I was going to value myself and how organised I was going to be. And the skills that I learned in being organised means that I look after myself and I do a lot better with bronchiectasis than somebody who's got the same disease but who doesn't value himself or who is totally disorganised.
Record number five.
This is the theme from the most wonderful television series I've ever seen called Sea Change. It was made in Australia. For some reason, it's never been shown here. It's about a woman who loses everything in her life and she packs up her children and off they go to start a new life. Well, some echoes in my life, but it's a wonderful series. And when I'm on this island and needing to watch television, I'll play one of the episodes of Sea Change through my mind's eye.
Wendy Morrison and Richard Pleasant singing the theme to the Australian television series Sea Change. So it was in your 40s, Dorothy Rowe, that slow process, as you've described, of discovering happiness gained ground, and then you founded and became head of a department of clinical psychology in the east of England, and then after that you started writing your books about depression. You really found a gap in the market there. I mean, they had huge success, didn't they?
There's been very little written about depression that gets across to people their own experience. So many, many people have said to me with my book, Depression, The Way Out of Your Prison, you wrote that book about me. And it's, you know, I'm being told this by somebody I've only just met.
But what everyone listening to you will want to know is, did you send a book to your mother?
I sent my first book, The Experience of Depression, to her, and I dedicated it to my parents because I wanted their names to go on. And she never mentioned it to me. And my sister told me that she hadn't seen the dedication until my sister pointed it out to her. So I don't think she'd even opened it.
But did you ever travel back to Australia in the wake of all of this and confront your mother? Did you ever say to her, you made my life hell?
I was here for 10 years without the money to go back to Australia. When I went back, my mother was old and there was no point. I've often discussed this with my clients, you know, should my client go and confront his parents? And in some cases, if it's not so much a confrontation but a query, you know, did this really happen? Some parents are wonderful. They explain and they say, yes, that did happen, I'm sorry. But in some cases, there can be no explanation from the parent because the parent doesn't understand what's happened. You know, most parents try to do their best for their children. And a lot of parents cause their children a great deal of distress when the parent feels that they're acting out of the child's best interests. I'm only beating you for your own good, darling.
Record number six.
when my marriage was breaking up, I was really into the great Tchaikovsky pathetique that used to cheer me up enormously. You know, all the passion of the classic. But now I like the music of Mozart and Schubert, the poignancy rather than the passion. And Mozart has that wonderful elegance and clarity that good scientific theories have.
Part of the third movement of Mozart's Piano Sonata in C Major, played by Vladimir Horowitz. One of your chief guidelines for being happy, Dorothy, is looking after your friends. You must, therefore, it seems to me, approve of young people today who seem, to me anyway, to be much more supportive of their friends, much more tactile. You know, whether it's on Big Brother or Pop Idol, they're hugging each other, supporting each other the whole time.
Friendships become tremendously important to us. It's always been important, but now there's a much greater realisation how much we need our friends and we need to look after them and we need to contact them, as you say, by hugging them and kissing and being close in that way. But also in understanding that if you want to have a good friend, you have to be a good friend. And of course, a lot of older people don't understand that.
So what are the guidelines for being happy? Is there a recipe for happiness? Looking after your friends, looking after yourself, obviously.
Yeah. Well, first of all, to realise that if you make happiness your goal, then it won't happen because happiness is always a byproduct. First of all, you must value and accept yourself. And if you value and accept yourself, you won't be frightened of other people. It means you've got good relationships, lots of good friends. And you'll look after yourself physically and as a person. You know, you'll make sure that people don't walk all over you. And when you value and accept yourself, you feel that you're part of the world, part of society, part of nature. And so you have that lovely sense of being joined to everything. It's the opposite of being depressed.
Record number 7.
I find it very curious that a young man born in a different country in another century understood how I experience being alive, just that sense of being alive. And I find that in Schubert. His unfinished symphony has got that wonderful sweetness and mystery of being alive.
Part of the second movement of Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, number 8 in B minor, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Well, now, I presume a psychologist would know exactly how to cope alone on a desert island. How would you do it, Dorothy?
I've decided that this must be an island in the Maldives or the Great Barrier Reef. If I went to the Hebrides, I'd be dead in a week. And yes, of course I can cope.
Can you? Can you ward off the panic attacks when you hear the rustling in the bushes?
The desert islands I'm familiar with don't have many bushes to rustle. So, no.
Well, you know, even if there are no bushes, there's something that's going to come in the night to get you, surely.
I never have any fears of something coming in the night to get me. I very much live within myself. I have a whole fund of stories to tell myself, conversations to have with my friends. I'll be fine.
You see yourself through?
Well, I expect to, because I think I could manage reasonably well on a desert island. And the kind of island I'm thinking about, it will only be a week or two before a boat goes by loaded with Japanese tourists, their cameras at the ready, and I'll be rescued.
Last record.
The last record is Schubert Symphony No. 9, because it is so alive and so wonderful. It's all that passion of living and rushing on and what lies ahead and what's happening now, and beautiful things in it I can dance to.
End of Schubert's Symphony No. 9, the Great C Major, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. Now, if you could only take one of those 8 records, which one would you take?
Oh, the Great C Major, because it's got everything in it.
You've got the Bible to read, you've got the complete works of Shakespeare to read. What else do you want?
I'm always worried that I haven't got enough to read. So I'll take a book I've just bought, The Oxford Companion to the Body, edited by Colin Blakemore and Sheila Jennett. And it's a beautiful, thick book, full of stuff I can learn, lots of interesting stories from history, beautiful pictures.
And what about your luxury?
This will be my snorkelling suit my son gave me, a special outfit to ward off the sun's rays, beautiful, well-fitting goggles with my glasses prescription. And I shall just snorkel my time away.
Dorothy Rowe, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.